This is not an easy topic. So as we go through it, at least with the main text in Revelation 20, I would really be pleased if you would open your Bible and stare at it, because the little jot and tittle details are so important, and we will need much concentration in certain areas. I'm not going to get to the point of the talk until Roman numeral number 5 on the handout. So we will go through 4 Roman numerals on the handout before I get to the point of the talk, but we will be dealing with the main text. Number 5 on the handout will tell us what the little season is for, which is the objective of our remarks today. As you can see on the handout, the text is Revelation 20, verses 7 to 10. And please allow me to read through it first. And when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the sea. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Well, our first point is, when is the little season? Which we saw in verse 7. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. So the little season is not until the entire millennial age is gone. In other words, the little season is in the next day, in the 8th day. It is not a part of the creative day of rest, the 7,000 years since Adam's fall. It is an exclusive peek into the ages to come. Normally, we tend to link it to the age that was, but it's not. It is an opening to the ages to come. And I think it's important for us to realize that this is the only place the little season is mentioned. It's nowhere else in Scripture that I'm aware of. And I know we as brethren like to get all the loose details knit together, but there are a number of prophecies which for various reasons ignore certain things. For instance, we don't have to ask in every prophecy, what about the great company? Because it's just simply ignored. And we don't have to ask in every prophecy, what about the little season? Because it is simply ignored. It is something special and unique, which is taught to us here in Revelation 20, and that's it. But it is taught for us because it's important. All right, the next point on your handout. Who Satan is. We saw in verse 7, when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. There is a very important detail which it is very easy to overlook, but there are 2 Satans in Scripture. There is the literal Satan, the being himself. But there is also a symbolic Satan. And this one that we are looking at in Revelation, like nearly everything else in Revelation, is symbolic. And while the literal devil is behind all of this, this is not about him. This is about the symbolic Satan, not the literal Satan. They are not the same. Well, let's define Satan here by first going to chapter 12 of Revelation. And this is a place that Brother Russell handles very admirably. Going to read 12:9. The great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. If you are familiar with Brother Russell's treatment of this, and you should be, because it's very excellent, Brother Russell points out that the dragon here in chapter 12 is civil power. At that time, that was Rome. But this is the point in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation has relatively little to say about the literal devil, but it has a great deal to say about the symbolic one. And you might notice here that we have four specific parts: dragon, serpent, devil, and Satan. It's probably best to start with dragon, because if you notice, it is separated. The great dragon was thrown down. And then it explains that it's also the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan. So these are subtitles. And the reason they are subtitles is all of these have slight nuances, and they are important in prophetic contexts. So we will see various uses of these names, but they are all about the same civil power or dragon. The civil power is Satan's or Lucifer's tool for much of what he does with humanity. We've got to understand the importance of the dragon here. Back in chapter 20, as being the same dragon that we have in chapter 12. Okay, now, back to chapter 20. You will notice in verse 2, we have nearly what we read back in chapter 12. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. These are the only two places in Revelation, the only two places in the whole Bible where this four-named entity occurs. And it occurs here in chapter 20 because the Revelator wants us to understand that this is the same critter we saw back in chapter 12. This is not something different. This is not about the binding of the literal devil. This is about the binding of civil power for the millennium. Now, dragon is the generic term for civil power. But the following three names represent the characteristics of how this tool gets used by the one who is behind it all. I never want anybody to think that the personal devil isn't here in chapter 20, but he's behind the scenes. The being is in the background, but the chapter is not about the being. The chapter is about his tool of civil power. And it is exercised or expressed by these three subtitles with subtle differences. We may recall that serpent was first encountered early in Genesis, and he was the deceiver. Now, let me suggest that in prophecy, serpent is going to stress that subtlety of civil power. It is there for deception. That is the objective when we see the word serpent. Then we see devil, which means adversary, as in a challenger. So when we see devil, it is pointing out that civil power as a tool of the literal devil is there because he's challenging God all the time. That's the subtle nuance of that name. And the third one, Satan, which does occur here in verse 7 of chapter 20 that we started with, means accuser. So deceiving is his objective. He is an adversary of God, but his tactic is to accuse. Back in verse 2, Jesus laid hold of the dragon. Jesus, upon his return, lays hold on civil power, and it's been degenerating ever since because it is being bound. And while dragon represents civil power in general, verse 7 is Satan because his tactic will be to accuse God. In other words, the little season is a replay of the Garden of Eden. If you'll recall, the personal devil there appeared as a serpent, but his objective, contained in the word Satan, was to accuse God. You remember what he said to Eve? Has God said? Well, there's your accusation. His accusation was God was a liar. Okay, so here, Jesus lays hold on the civil power, but Satan, because his tactic will be to accuse God, is a hint of what will happen during the little season. Now, the next point, Brother Larry, if you can move. Oh, it's there. Okay, sorry. Next page, Brother Larry. Thank you. Who? We got a lot of who's in these verses we read. But we want to identify all nations and Gog and Magog in verse 8. Let me read verse 8. Taking the name or subject from verse 7, Satan, in the form of civil power, will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. So we've got a couple things here. We've got the dragon as a deceiver, hence called Satan. Excuse me. As a deceiver, hence later called a serpent, or earlier called it. But the dragon as a deceiver comes out against. Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive. Now, the reason he has to come out is he was bound for the millennium. And where does he come out, or where he comes out to deceive? But notice what he comes out to deceive. The nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. Here, it gets very tricky, and we must concentrate very, very carefully. Satan is not Gog and Magog. Satan comes out to deceive the nations of the earth, Gog and Magog. In other words, the nations are Gog and Magog. Now, this shouldn't seem too strange to us, because we know at the end of the harvest now, when Gog and Magog comes against Israel, who is it that comes against Israel? It is all nations. This is tricky. Concentration is very necessary. Let me go to Zechariah, just to make the point about all nations. And you already know this. This is not a strange thought to you. It's just going to be worded a little differently. Zechariah 14:2. I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle. I suspect everybody in this audience believes that is the same invasion that happens in Ezekiel 38:9, where we refer to the invaders as Gog and Magog. So, therefore, I suspect what's on your handout there, you already believe, even though you haven't thought about it, all nations equals Gog and Magog. Satan is not Gog and Magog. All nations are Gog and Magog. I am showing you on the handout a comparison between the gospel harvest and the little season. You will see that in each one, we've got all nations and we've got Gog and Magog. What we need to do is look very carefully. In the gospel harvest, all nations and Gog and Magog are the people under their civil powers now in this world. They are already deceived. They don't have to be deceived in this scenario. The world is deceived. And what is their objective? All nations come against Jerusalem. It's a localized target. All of the nations, Gog and Magog of the whole world, the civil powers of the world, come against a localized target. That's Israel. Now, I've also shown there under the gospel harvest, Gog and Magog from Ezekiel 38, the deceived nations. We need to understand the etymology of the terminology. Gog means mountain, Magog means great mountain. We may not often think of it, but again, it's something we all know, that the civil powers of this world have spiritual unseen powers behind them. So Gog is the mountain or the visible powers. Magog is the great mountain or the invisible powers. You recall this, I am sure, from your study of Daniel, chapter 10, in verses 13 and 20. You will recall that Gabriel apologizes to Daniel. He said, I was on my way, but the prince of Persia stopped me. Well, you know, Gabriel is not going to get stopped by some human being who's a prince of Persia. He got stopped by the fallen angel who was the unseen, the Magog, invisible power behind Persia. When you get down to verse 20, he says, I got to go through the same thing again with the prince of Greece. He's not talking about a human prince of Greece. He is talking about an invisible Magog spiritual power that he's going to have to do battle with. This is so important to our subject here because Gog and Magog appears in two places, and we cannot understand it unless we understand that it is a reference to the visible and the invisible powers, civil powers. So in the gospel harvest, the attackers are the people. The attackers are all nations. The attackers are Gog and Magog. Slip down now to in the little season. I'm going to read it again in verse 8 of chapter 20 in Revelation. Satan will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. Why does it say four corners of the earth? It's the same as Zechariah's all nations. Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog are the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. But now here is the difference. The people in the little season are not the attackers. They are the attacked. Satan comes out to deceive or to attack all of the nations all over the face of the earth. At that point, all of the nations are not deceived like they are now. It's past the millennial age. They are not deceived. They know God from the least unto the greatest. But the dragon comes out to deceive them. It's not localized. In Ezekiel 38, the attack was on Israel. That's localized. But this attack is all over the face of the earth. Gog and Magog are the redeemed nations here. Gog, the visible peoples. Magog, the invisible kingdom. Well, that took concentration. I hope the concept stuck. Let's proceed. What kind of test the little season is? It is a civil test. And we know that because it is the dragon, civil power, that was put in the abyss and is released afterward in order to deceive. So this is without question a civil test. We've got an additional clue to that in verse 10. The devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and false prophet are also. The beast and the false prophet were thrown into the lake of fire at the end of the gospel harvest. So the test is not religious. It is civil. It's the dragon, not the beast and the false prophet. This test is also deceptive. In other words, it's not for obedience. This is a main concept when we're talking about the little season. The little season is not for obedience. That was tested in the millennium. It is for deception. It is to see if deception is possible for those who have come through the millennium. All right, let's take some other symbols from these verses. Verse 8 mentions war. Satan comes out to gather the nations for war. Now, I know scriptures mention warfare by God, but Satan likes war. And this is his idea. People at that time don't have war on their minds. It's farthest thing from their minds after coming through the millennium. So this little war is Satan's idea. It is very much the same as three things, or the same as two things. Let me read again. You don't have to turn to it. Back to Revelation 12:7. There was war in heaven. Michael, that's false religion, and the angels waging war with the dragon, that's the Roman Empire. And the dragon and the angels waged war. So back there at the beginning of the gospel age, the religious and the civil powers of Rome had a war. It was Satan's idea. The gospel harvest, Ezekiel 38. We have the dragon versus Israel. That's his war. Now, God permits it. But you realize that that war in Ezekiel 38 is to do away with Israel. That's not God's plan. That's Satan's plan. And now the little season in the eighth day, what's the war? It is the dragon via civil power versus the redeemed race of mankind. That's what the war is. And in describing the nations, Gog and Magog, verse 8 ends by saying, the number of them is like the sand of the sea. We all know enough about the Abrahamic promise to know what that means. The sand of the sea is Abraham's earthly seed. The number of them, the redeemed, is like the sand of the sea. In other words, it is Abraham's earthly seed, the one that was promised to him, the one that was developed all the way during the millennial age. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth. That expression is to say everywhere. You can remember the Gog and Magog scenario. Now at the end of the harvest will be just in Israel. But this is everywhere because it is an attack on every human being that has been redeemed. And the next two things surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Considering what time it is in history there in the little season, I'm going to suggest camp of the saints is the earth. It is Abraham's sand of the sea seed. So the civil power, the satanic power, surrounds the camp of the saints, the earth, and the beloved city. The spiritual rulership. We might say that's Gog and Magog, huh? Gog is the earthly seed. Magog is the beloved spiritual city behind it, just like we saw in a very different kind of application earlier in Daniel. All nations have spiritual powers behind them. So camp of the saints is the earthly seed. Beloved city is the spiritual rulership behind it. Can you imagine the gall of the devil to try to surround the spiritual power of the divine city? Well, he's deceived spirit beings before. And at this point, he is so desperate and has gone to the place of such insanity that he's going to try to do that. He's going to surround both the earth and the spiritual rulership behind it. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Now, the them is not the seed. It's the civil power, devil and his angels. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. That will be goodbye to civil power as it was 1,000 years earlier to religious power. Now, let's take a look at this just for clarity's sake. Revelation 16. Again, you know this verse, but you may not be applying it in connection with what we're talking about. 16:13. I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. It's part of the sixth plague in the harvest now. What I want us to see is the three characters that are in this verse. And Brother Russell again tells us what they are. He says dragon is civil power. We are being consistent from Revelation 12 here into Revelation 16 and into Revelation 20. Dragon is civil power. Brother Russell also tells us that beast and false prophet are religious powers. They are not a factor in Revelation 20 because they get put into a pit 1,000 years earlier, which takes us to chapter 19. But before I go there, just want to mention this point. It is really helpful in prophecy to follow the characters all the way to their end. So in 16:13 of Revelation, we've got dragon, beast, and false prophet. We need to follow the three to their conclusion because they're all listed here together. They all must be dealt with eventually. Now, go to chapter 19:29. This is the end of the harvest in which we now are. It says 19:29. There is no 19:29. 19:20. Is what I want. Let me correct my own handout there. The beast was seized. The beast was seized. And with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. There's your false prophet. That's two of the three things we saw in Revelation 16. And it specifies that these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. You see, they make it into that lake of fire now, the end of this harvest. But it specifies only two of them. And we should be saying, if our mind has remembered all the way back to chapter 13, back to chapter 16, well, where's the third one? Where's the dragon? And you might want to notice the next chapter. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key in the abyss and his great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon. There's the third one. There's the civil power. And it gets bound for 1,000 years. Okay. Next thing on the outline. Number two, the chart of the ages. And it has to take a moment here just because. The chart of the ages shows the little season as second death. That's always bothered me. I mean, it does happen there. And that is probably the last time it ever happens. But second death occurs during the millennium also. Second death occurs even in the gospel age. So putting second death on the chart there might make it look exclusive to that period, and that could be misleading. So in my mind, at least, I would prefer if it said little season, because that's what it is. Second death is a factor in the little season. Let me also mention couple things because they relate to the chart. The little season is not a harvest of the millennial age. Let me repeat. The little season is not a harvest of the millennial age. As a matter of fact, if you think about the millennial age, it is a harvest of the entire seventh creative day, the day in which God rests. Doesn't the sheep and the goats parable show that? What's the point of the millennium? It is to separate sheep from goats. And those are people. And those people go all the way back to Eden. The millennial age is a harvest of the entire permission of evil, period. It separates, which is what a harvest is, the stuff you want, in this case, sheep, versus the stuff you don't want, in this case, goats. All men from all time in the millennial age are separated into sheep or goats. That is a harvest of God's whole plan for mankind. So no, the little season is not a harvest of the millennium. Which brings me now to number 3 on your handout. We might think that the little season is a harvest of the millennial age, unless we straighten out something that a lot of us talk about, and sometimes it frightens me. Let's talk about who goes into the little season. What are their characteristics? They go into the little season in absolute perfection of flesh and character. Let me repeat. They go into the little season in absolute perfection of flesh and character. Those of you who know me well know I get on soapboxes. So if I get excited about this, I'm on a soapbox. But I think this is so important because we can spoil the meaning of millennial age if we think people are going into the little season with hidden flaws. That's wrong. There is nothing hidden in these people. They are the products of the resurrection, the restanding with God. They are absolutely perfect in flesh and in character. This is what I call the clean slate doctrine. I just made it up, but it's very handy for me. And it is shown here on your handout under the term the work of the mediator. In Isaiah 11:3, it shows that Jesus does not judge by sight or hearing. Well, if he doesn't, what's he judging by? Obviously, he's looking in the interior. There's nothing going to be hidden. It is beyond the senses. The work of the mediator lets nothing slip by. 1 Samuel 16:7, the Lord looks on the heart. Well, where are you going to hide something? Nothing slips by the mediator. Jeremiah 31:33, the New Covenant text. He will write it where? In their heads? No. On their hearts. There will be nothing hiding that has to be purged later. Acts 3:21, restitution of all things. That takes you back to Adam before he sinned. There was nothing hiding in Adam. Even when he sinned, we know there was nothing hiding in him. He did it because he had a bad reasoning process. Do we or do we not believe it's going to be restored to what Adam was before he sinned? Nothing hiding in him. John 1:29, the Lamb taketh away the sin of the world. He removes the faults. He doesn't ignore them. He doesn't let them hide. He takes it away. 1 Corinthians 15:25-26. He must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet, and the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. If you've got sin hiding in you, you're still dying. This is the sheep and goats. He will put all enemies under his feet, including death. He will have vanquished death. He will remove all remnants of what causes it. This is what I call the clean slate doctrine. Those who go into the little season are clean. The mediator does not fail. He does not hand damaged goods over to the Father. He turns over the race in absolute perfection. Okay, so much for the end of my soapbox. Therefore, the little season is a reenactment of the Eden scenario with certain adjustments. What was the real Eden problem? It wasn't hiding sin. With Eve, it was that she lacked faith in God's direction. Serpent could come along and tell her something different, and she was swayable because she lacked faith. We're getting to the reason for the season here. The problem in Eden was Eve lacked faith in God's directions. Adam lacked faith in God's abilities. We're getting to the reason for the little season. The reason is going to be related to faith. Okay, number four on your handout. A history of disobedience and deception. It's important for us to realize, and frequently we do not stress this fact, but there are two things that all people who will be in forever relationship with God will have to be free from any temptation to disobey. They will have to be free from any deception that comes along. Look at the history of it. In Eden, Eve was deceived. Adam disobeyed. The sentence was only because of what he did. There had been insufficient time for faith development. Therefore, there was no judgment based on faith development. Eve was deceived. The apostle makes that point. But the sentence was not pronounced there because it was not a test of faith. It was a test of obedience. Adam, on the other hand, was not deceived. He simply disobeyed. Under the law, they couldn't obey no matter how hard they tried. And in Deuteronomy 11:16, they were warned of deceptions. So the law kind of rested on those two things, and it was a picture of things to come. With the Spirit begotten, gospel age, in, let me read Hebrews 4:11. Sometimes I think I ought to write these out. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Okay, so the Spirit begotten here are warned against disobedience as being a threat to us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, I am afraid lest as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your mind should be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. So here we see that deception can waylay the Spirit begotten. And the fact is, we get judged on both. Unlike the race in Eden, we get judged both on obedience and I'm not being deceived. In the millennium, there will be no deception. That was in the text that we read. Revelation 20. Let me read verse 3. Threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he should not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years was completed. There is no deception in the millennium. None. But mankind can't be exempt from that, can they? That's why there's a little season. Mankind in the millennium is judged on obedience. 20 of Revelation verse 13. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. It was obedience. Works. But that's not the end of the test. The millennium and the little season combined will let man get both tests, just as the church does now. So the little season has a purpose. It is for deception. Not that God is deceiving, but he is allowing Satan, in this case in the form of a civil power, to deceive, because God needs that test. So, three of the five periods with only a single judgment. Eden was only by obedience. The mediation is only by obedience. The little season is only by deception. Those two things, deception and obedience, are imperative to anybody who will live with God forever and ever. Now to the point of our discourse. Number five, the foundation of the little season test. There's a verse used to give me a pain, and it's in Luke 20, but it is accurate. I know brethren have struggled to make it say something it doesn't. I used to do that. But this is a promise, and Jesus is speaking it. Luke 20, 36. Speaking of those that attain the eighth day. This is not, like I said, little season's not in this picture. It hasn't been mentioned in the Bible at this point. Those who are considered worthy to attain to that day, that's the eighth day, and the resurrection from the dead, complete perfection, neither married nor are given in marriage, for neither can they die anymore. Doesn't say neither will they die anymore. It says neither can they die anymore. And it's not because they're immortal. It's because of the test of the millennium plus the test of the little season gets them to the point where there is no possibility that they are going to be sinning against God in the future. This is a promise. Neither can they die anymore. And why can God make that promise? Because he will have had the millennium, which totally did away with sin and showed obedience. And he will have the little season, which proves that those who pass through it cannot be deceived. So, what is the actual test? Not the deception. Deception is civil power. It's the means of the test. The actual test is faith. Can you be trusted for eternity? You remember Hebrews 11:6, without faith it's impossible to please God. Well, if you're not going to please God, you're not going to get through the little season. And it is based on faith. The ancient worthies were justified by faith. The church are justified by faith. The world in the millennial age was justified, or is justified, by works. Something's a problem there. They need, as the others, a testing for their faith. They will ultimately be justified by their faith, because no matter what surprises the remote future will bring, they must respond in total faith. If they see an asteroid headed for the Earth, their response will be, I'm going to go hide in the cave? No. Their response will be, the Lord has it under control. That's what the little season is for, is to test that faith. No matter what surprises the remote future brings, the world must respond in total faith. God promised they cannot die past that point. He needs to know their faith and fidelity won't fail, or he couldn't have made a promise like that. The little season is not a test for flaws. It's a test of faith. May the Lord add his blessing. Oh, let me just add this. I think I've got enough time here allowed to me. The Psalms in the Night for April 14. Well, it's dealing with our age. Is so much along the lines of this concept that God puts faith as the premium on everything. Let me read it. Great is thy faith. Be it unto thee, even as thou wilt. Matthew 15:28. The more we study the subject of faith, the more we are convinced that in God's sight, faith is not only indispensable, but very precious. We cannot come to God without faith. We cannot abide in his love without faith. We cannot receive day by day his mercies and blessings and leadings except by faith in his promises. We cannot realize ourselves as his children, begotten of the Holy Spirit and heirs of God, joint heirs with Jesus Christ our Lord, except as we exercise faith in his word of promise to this effect. We cannot go on day by day following the Lord, except as we are willing to walk by faith and not by sight. For this is the test which he puts upon all of his followers. We cannot see how the oppositions of the world, flesh, and devil, which seem so baneful to us, are blessings in disguise, except as we exercise faith in God's promises that it will be so. We cannot therefore be prepared for the heavenly kingdom in its glories and blessings and privileges, except we now have and exercise the faith which will enable us to profit by various lessons given us in the school of Christ. And we can simply extend that into the little season and the ages to come.